Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin for your free 30-day trial.
If he hasn't made you mad yet, he will. Common Sense with Dan Carlin.
I am not megalomaniacally narcissistic enough to think that the last, shall we say, 40 days of incredibly important and big and interesting news stories is my fault. Just because I said I'm not going to do a Common Sense show until I finish the history show, and all these events start happening, which are huge and are like straws on a camel's back, tempting me to break my pledge and to do a current event show because each one is bigger and more astounding than the last. Which is why I put the chances that the last 40 days worth of huge news stories being my fault at a maximum like 20%. I'm not a narcissist, so maximum 20%. But it is a little strange, isn't it? Alex Jones would have a few thoughts about this. It's a little strange that I decide to stop talking about current events, and then all these current events pop up that are really important to talk about. Nonetheless, you know, maximum 20%. Did you miss me? Sorry about that. It's getting harder and harder to do two podcasts, and, well, once I saw the light at the end of the tunnel, I just went for it. And there's a lot to talk about, obviously. And I tried to figure out the best format for doing this. I hate those shows where we just talk about 50 subjects and give you a tiny little bit on each one. I think the last time we did something like this and ended up with a huge backlog of important stories, we just chose one or two and went real deep with them, which sort of argues for the opposite approach this time, just for the sake of balance. And there are a bunch of things that at least deserve updates. What about the presidential campaign? So since the last time we spoke, we've obviously entered the meat of the general elections. And as we also know, the general elections are different, aren't they? You are no longer trying to appeal to the base. You are now trying to appeal to the rest of the country. Well, maybe not the hardcore supporters on the other side, but certainly all the wonderfully independent folks who are the kingmakers nowadays in these elections. You don't have any sort of news outlet for you. You have no analysts on the big talk shows analyzing the election. I mean, CNN can have 700 analysts on set, but none of them are independent. It's frankly amazing when, again, this is about the fourth or fifth election where independents are the kingmakers. You would think somebody would be talking about that or expressing that point of view. I mean, us aside, come on, we're a podcast. You would think that this would be, you would think there would be 100 of these people out there. Which does bring us to one of the funny little angles that are cropping up because of this election. You know, Donald Trump is a very scary candidate, and I don't want to see Donald Trump elected, and neither Donald Trump nor Hillary Clinton talk at all about the priorities that really matter to me, and they scare the heck out of me because I don't think either one of them thinks the Constitution's more than a piece of paper, really. But he has done some things to the system that are, well, they're damaging to the system, but if you think the system needs to be fundamentally, you know, broken down to a lower level and then and rebuilt, sort of like a rotting house foundation, maybe it's not altogether negative. And one of the things that he's done is unite the Republican status quo and the Democratic establishment together to protect the two-party system. And as I've said many times, a lot of what I would like to see is simply a better understanding amongst the general population that all this stuff is going on, because I don't think it can really stand the light of day. I think part of the way our system gets away with doing some of the things some of us are astounded about is because most people don't know about it. And the more you have to display these things in public, it was a little like, you know, just as a microcosm, the idea of superdelegates woke a lot of people up to the idea that things are a little bit more complex than maybe they just knew when they were going about their daily lives, assuming certain facts. In this case, there's a halfway decent chance, I don't know what a halfway decent chance is, we'll just call it a halfway decent chance, that we will get a third party representative in the presidential debates for the first time since 1992. Now, of course, if you listen to this program, you know, for any period of time, you know why that's a little wild, and it's because we have a special group of people, a little like CNN's panel, where half of them are Democrats and half of them are Republicans, all of them party faithful, who decide who gets to be in the debates and what the standards are for inclusion. And surprise, surprise, Democrats and Republicans get in automatically. The other people who might want to be involved have to meet a well, raised the bar a couple of times, set of criteria that nobody's ever reached. So, not a surprise that since the bar was raised after Ross Perot got in 1992, we haven't seen any third-party people or independent people anymore. And there's been lawsuits and presidential candidates trying to get in, and just not going to happen. So why might it happen this year? Gary Johnson, from the latest polls I've seen, he's the Libertarian candidate. We've had him on the program the last election cycle. Might try to have him on again. Jill Stein we had on also. She's running again. But here's the thing. The polls that I've seen on Johnson don't seem to make him that close to the artificially high requirements that this bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates has arbitrarily set. But because he would likely take support from Trump, and because Trump is a threat to the Democratic and Republican establishment, they can unite on an issue that, just like normally keeping a third party or independent candidate out protects the status quo, that in this case, putting a third party or independent candidate in the debate, especially if they tend to draw from the conservative side, will protect the status quo. How do you protect the Democratic and Republican parties at this point from what Donald Trump is doing to them? You include somebody who's not a Democrat or Republican into the normally quite cloistered debate because they'll take support away from Trump. The machinations are open. This is politics. I mean, when people say it's just politics, that's what this is. It's when other people say it's just business. I had to put those cement overshoes on you and drop you in the river. It's just business. You understand. Nothing personal. I like you. I like your wife and your kids are wonderful. So it's just politics, folks. And it's always been dirty and eye gouging. But the more out in the open it is, the more we all understand it. We meaning voters. So wouldn't it be ironic if this entity designed to protect the status quo when it comes to Democrats and Republicans and have done a pretty exclusive job of it since 1992, opened up their doors and relaxed their rules to get somebody in because some other guy was really not a Republican or a Republican in sheep's clothing. Bernie Sanders was a Democrat in sheep's clothing. That's how you have to run. We said, instead of being an independent or a third party candidate, I mean, the way the system is built, you're better off a stealth candidate in one of the big two parties. I mean, a perfect example of what Johnson's dealing with is the wonderful little traps in the system. And we've talked about this all the time, the roadblocks towards independent and third-party candidates. I mean, the Libertarian Party has been a party darn near as long as I've been alive. On virtually, I think they've been on every presidential election since at least 72. Do they go back to 68, Ben? 72 for sure. I knew the vice presidential candidate, Toni Nathan, who was the vice presidential candidate, the running mate, as she always liked to say, the first woman on any presidential ticket, I believe, was her claim to fame, the late Toni Nathan. But nonetheless, you know, it's not like they just arrived on the scene yesterday, okay? And yet there are places that you almost assuredly must win in order to become president. And those places tend to be the hardest to get on the ballot or the ones with the hidden traps. I mean, Ohio is a perfect example. Johnson's campaign is trying to overcome hurdles in Ohio that should not be there. But they're there because, you know, the parties can give on some of these states. Oh, yeah, Oregon. Okay, make it seem like everybody can run and it's all great and the whole thing. But we don't need Oregon. Nobody needs Oregon. But Ohio, okay, lock something down there. Put a speed bump there. Because if you don't get Ohio, boom, that's a huge nail in your coffin politically. So we're watching some of these traps be exposed because people are tripping them. Johnson's tripping them in Ohio, and it's tripping him up in this debate. But because he would take away from Trump, presumably, the Democrats and Republicans might cut him some slack, make it easier for him to get in there, grease the wheels a little bit. It's fun to watch the machinations when they have to come out into the light of day and do them in front of all of us. Now, that having been said, what's the state of the campaign? Well, you know, we said earlier that the generals would be different because the press would not be enjoying Donald Trump so much at that point. It's fun to watch him. I mean, if you're CNN, and if you're CNN, I don't understand how it helps your brand at all to look so into the tank, even if Donald Trump's a disaster for one side or the other. I mean, just it doesn't even if you're branding strategy is to try to appeal to a certain political demographic like Fox or MSNBC was doing, I get it. But if you're trying to be, ABC, CBS, NBC to be so in the tank, even though I can hear the conservatives out there going, Dan, are you saying those other networks aren't in the tank? I think CNN's gone beyond whatever the old optics line used to be. Not that I watch, of course, but, you know, I am in airports and hotels sometimes. But now that, you know, it's not as fun to watch him tearing up or trying to tear up Democrats, you can start to see the real power that can be focused on his gaffes. And I, along with everybody else in the world, had said that Trump was going to sabotage himself by what he said. But I and everyone in the world thought this would have happened a long time ago. As we said in an earlier show, you know, there are some things maybe we overlooked. One would be that things that the elite media, for lack of a better word, the elite media, including podcasters, of course, that maybe we overlooked is that the things that Trump said that we're outraged by and think, well, that rules you out right there, didn't upset some of the people who like Trump as much as we thought it should. Maybe he said all these folks from Mexico or some, you know, I get in trouble every time I try to quote him because they'll say I misquoted him. But I mean, you know what he said about Mexicans and drug users and rapists and whatever he said. And there will be people out there who, instead of being outraged by that, like the media assumes they should be, are instead going, yeah, that's what I think about him, too. That guy's speaking to me. Didn't David Duke come out of the woodworks, our former KKK guy, and say, you know, it's his time now, apparently. The climate is ripe. Maybe more on the climate in a minute. Now, from where we stand today, and I think this is the only way to be gauging this race right now, it's like trying to call a sporting event in the middle of the sporting event. One side may score a couple of touchdowns, and it looks like it's over, but it's a weird campaign, and strange things can happen, and let's not forget the things that Hillary Clinton could, I mean, anything could happen is a good way to put it, still. But at the moment, it looks like the sheer volume of Trumpisms are starting to add up and kill him. Now, I do want to say that it is once again fascinating to hear the discussions over your responsibility as a voter from the people that want you to vote for their candidate. I mean, I get this a lot as a longtime independent. I mean, as I've pointed out many times, I haven't voted for a Democratic or Republican candidate for president since 1992. It is not some claim to fame or some badge of honor. It simply is reflective of I haven't liked any of them and I haven't trusted any of them. And I'm being told once again in this election that I must vote for Hillary Clinton because otherwise I will be enabling an Adolf Hitler to come into the White House. I'm reading, I mean, my goodness, they are over and over in everything. The Washington Post had one the other day where this is just how you're essentially negligent and you are opening the door to a historic, I mean, how dare you think about voting anything other than for Hillary Clinton right now because you will give the election to the bad guy. And, you know, I just want to say that this lesser of two evils thing, it's fascinating if you live long enough now to watch it for a while because you get this in every election, just so you know. I know we have a lot of people who tune into this program who are just sort of waking up to this. Maybe this is their first election. And so they haven't seen the same trends and the same thing. But over and over, this is what you get, folks. You get that one person is, you know, maybe not all that exciting, or maybe you have significant worries about them or what have you, but the other person is frightful, scary. I mean, let's just take, for example, the one that when I was in political science classes in college, they were still studying this because it was so the template for it. The 1964 election between Lyndon Johnson, the sitting president at the time, by the way, he had taken over after Kennedy was shot. So this was the first time he was actually running for president. And he was running against Barry Goldwater, a senator, Republican. Goldwater was tough, right? He was very anti-communist, had a libertarian streak too. But I mean, his attitude was very much, I mean, he had a great line that's been overused and abused, but it was a quotable line. He said, extremism in the cause of liberty is no vice. And it was part of a larger phrase. But I mean, fascinating guy. And in later years, an interesting guy to listen to. But nonetheless, the political ads at the time were apocalyptic. The most famous political ad of all time, the most iconic, has to be, doesn't it? The Lyndon Johnson campaign ad that shows the little girl pulling the petals off the flower. And then the nuclear bomb going off in her, I don't remember if it's in the flower, reflected in her pupils, you know, with the countdown, 5, 4, 3, 2, and then some Barry Goldwater speech line thrown over it in his own words. It's an absolute masterstroke of political ad making, but it's one of those perfect examples of tried and true, paid their dues, very experienced, competent manager who might not be so sexy and wonderful, but they're running against a dangerous, crazy person, right? That's dangerous, crazy person, not a bad adjective for this character, right? The competent bureaucrat against the dangerous, crazy person. Okay, so in 1972, everything is flipped. This time, the not very exciting, competent, paid their dues person is Richard Nixon, the sitting president, by the way. Happened to be man of the year a couple of times, I believe, by this point, while president. But still, tricky dick. Intensely dislikable. I mean, when people talk about Hillary Clinton's problem with voters today and her unpopularity or her likability factor, it's very Nixonian. And like Nixon, she comes in with quite a lot of experience, but nobody gives a damn. I mean, they're just, Nixon rubbed people wrong, and Hillary Clinton rubs a lot of people wrong. And in 72, remember, the Democratic Party had essentially been taken over by the anti-war wing, and their candidate was George McGovern, who was perceived to be a dangerous, crazy man when it comes to the political status quo, because McGovern was one of these guys that was saying, let's get out of Vietnam. Well, right there, dangerous, crazy man. There were other things, too. He was perceived as way too liberal for the country at the time. He was absolutely destroyed by Nixon, the paid his dues, competent, even though he was dislikable president. That, by the way, is the election where Watergate eventually got involved that would be uncovered later. And the irony of the whole thing, of course, is that the Watergate thing stemmed from Nixon being afraid he was going to need some extra stuff to beat the Democratic nominee. But the Democratic nominee turned out to be a dangerous, crazy man. He would have been crushed no matter what. Now, in 1980, we had an interesting situation because we essentially had the fulfillment of the 1964 Goldwater Revolution, this time embodied by Ronald Reagan. And people forget now, but let me remind those who weren't there. Reagan was perceived by a lot of people as a dangerous, crazy man. He's been lionized and mythologized since. He's become the John F. Kennedy of the conservative folks because he's been lionized and mythologized too. But he certainly turned out to be a lot less scary than people perceived him to be, say, in the mid-1970s or in 1980. I mean, the idea, once again, of like a nuclear war seemed to threaten with Reagan. That kind of approach scared people in terms of World War III. And so it was dangerous, crazy man against failed president, which is the way Carter was viewed. There's an election for you. Failed president against dangerous, crazy man. And I would say it's been a while since we've had the dangerous crazy man candidate, unless you're on the real fringes. Because there's always somebody, if you're on the fringe of the far left or the far right, they may all be dangerous crazy people to you. But nonetheless, it's been a while since we've had the dangerous crazy person candidate. Now we do. And the difference between, say, Trump and somebody like Barry Goldwater is obviously Barry Goldwater was a person who, call him dangerous, crazy man if you want, but he's a sitting senator. He's part of the establishment one way or the other. It's almost more of the political tool, right? The lesser of two evils. And this is just politics, right? It's just business. I mean, politics. Hillary is running on competency, paid her dues, experience, trustworthiness. I mean, you know, I'm not going to become a crazy person. And she's painting her opponent as a dangerous, crazy man. And her opponent is doing everything he can to add evidence to her portfolio on him, on opposition research. I mean, my God, folks, have we ever had someone so seemingly uncaring about what he says? I mean, just to be taken seriously, don't you have to show some interest in getting it more right than you have? It's okay to make gaffes. These are politicians, too. I mean, not Trump per se, although, you morph into one the more you spend time doing it. But, I mean, it's understandable that you may have lies and gaffes, but to not show more of an interest, I mean, there is, I think you could say, amongst a lot of politicians, a little bit of a personality disorder. I know some have it, some don't. So, I mean, it's obviously not 100%. There are normal people in there. But Trump takes this to the next level. I mean, listen to most politicians talk about themselves. Now, obviously, part of what they have to do is running is give you their resume. So a lot of it is, I did this. But if you listen to them, there's some sort of invisible line someplace, and your psyche kind of knows where it is more than there being an official number, where after a while you're going, you know, this is a lot more than just spouting your resume. This is something about yourself where, I mean, do we all know people like this where they have to tell you about themselves and how great? I mean, Obama does this a lot, where you'll watch his speech and you'll think to yourself, okay, enough. Stop telling me. I used to work with a guy who did this, and his thing was he was going to tell you all about himself rather than, you know, what you were there to hear. Maybe you were there to buy some product, but you were going to hear about this guy's entire career as a reason why you should just trust him on the product. And after a while, I just determined, because, you know, we would have these strategy sessions where we'd say, don't do this, don't do that. After a while, you just determined that that wasn't something he was almost even consciously aware of. That's how eventually the presentation style developed, where you watch these people and either consciously or unconsciously, because sometimes these people are reading speeches that other people wrote, it comes off as completely narcissistic. I'm sorry, Trump has a personality disorder, and I think you can see it on camera. And I think the problem for someone like yours truly is I have wanted an outsider for so long, and I've said this before on this program. This is like some cruel, cosmic, karmic joke on people like me, because I finally get my outsider, and he's someone that clearly has issues. And I'm sorry if you're a Trump supporter and that upsets you, but you may be a lot like me in some respects, waiting so long to have someone from outside the system to give the system a bloody nose. And I think he is giving the system a bloody nose. The problem is we may all drown in the carnage before this is all over. And, well, bottom line, we're all going to get someone we don't like for president, I think. No matter who wins. A country that wanted to fix this problem would look at the system and say, why is this always what we get? I mean, I just ran down several elections for you where these weren't elections where people were excited about candidates. These were elections where you were told, you know, vote for the candidate who looks sleazy, insider, tricky, you know, fill in the blank, and the dangerous, crazy person. At some point, you know, you would think that people would somehow say, you know, this system needs some reform so that we don't get so many dangerous, crazy people and we get better candidates on the other side. As I've said before, folks, if Donald Trump becomes the president, Democrats are going to blame everybody in the world for not voting for their candidate. But their candidate was almost coronated. Remember, she's running against a 70-something-year-old Democratic socialist who's been a Democratic Party member for 5 minutes, and he did great against her, which shows her weakness. O'Malley was her opponent for a while. I mean, folks, that is a gimme. That is a gimme right there. Do you realize, and I am not a Joe Biden fan at all, do you realize, and I think he does now, and he's probably kicking himself, do you realize what Joe Biden would be doing in this election if he were in Hillary's place? Do you realize how out of control over this would be, unless Biden had said something wonderful, and, you know, he has a tendency. But I guess my point is if you don't pick someone who is one of the least likable candidates in modern history as your candidate, then the other guy who is also going to be one of the least likable candidates in modern history doesn't have a shot. You opened up the door to that. And you Republicans, I mean, your candidates suck too. So at what point do you sit there and say, listen, the reforms we need here are reforms that give us better candidates? And how is our process of weeding people out, you know, taking good people out of the system? The truth is, I believe both of those parties like it this way. And that every now and then something just gets messed up. And that's what this year is. But I think, you know, what the Presidential Debate Commission, considering Gary Johnson, is all about in my mind is an attempt to basically say, you know, we can fix this. We can still do this. Don't worry. We have some tools in our toolbox to get things back to the way they should be. The idea, by the way, that the Russians are hacking Democratic National Committee computers and then are using outlets like WikiLeaks to disseminate the info to affect the news cycle in the United States is fascinating. Welcome to the new world, right? Has this ever happened before? I keep thinking to myself that maybe it has. But the fact that Trump's campaign seems more likely to sort of violate certain lines that usually national security establishment American candidates for both parties wouldn't go near makes it positive. I mean, he came out and said that comment once again, which you tend to think is just going off at the mouth a little bit, but sometimes he says them in multiple speeches in the same day. So you sit there and go, all right, that's more of a talking point than a slip. But I mean, he appeared to encourage Russia, or saying, you know, hey, they're going to release Hillary Clinton emails, that's fine, or something like that, which, you know, the whole establishment went crazy. But the other thing maybe that makes it possible and relatively new is there are these outlets like WikiLeaks to disseminate them. So when I said earlier that if you were going to bet today on where the campaign's going, you might say to yourself, well, you know, Trump's going to get himself killed. He's going to get Goldwatered, or he's going to get McGoverned, or he's going to get Cartered, or he's going to get Mondaled. You know, you can go on and on and on. He's going to get doled. Those are all good adjectives, aren't they? But we don't know what's going to happen next, do we? We don't know what's going to come out next. And I have to tell you this, you know, I'm split on this because, you know, I'm a big privacy guy. And I think everybody spies too much, and we're all under surveillance too much. You know, I mean, I think we've gone just berserk in that, and we've forgotten things like the Fourth Amendment, and politicians and everybody should have Fourth Amendment rights too. At the same time, I do feel a little bit different sometimes when the stuff that's being exposed is stuff that America, it's not specifically each individual case stuff that Americans should have a right to see, but what it shows you is what's behind the curtain. And Americans have a right to see what's behind the curtain in the big picture sense. And unfortunately, I get in trouble because all these little disclosures, which I would argue a lot of times, listen, that's a protected email. These people should be allowed to converse in private. I would suggest that sometimes it's all those things put together that build the picture that shows Americans what's behind the curtain, which I think they have a right to see. So I'm conflicted about that. I don't know what to think about that. It puts a couple of my various viewpoints at odds with each other. That's not the only issue, by the way, that that happens on. And I'm sure I'm not the only person it happens to, right? All right, next. I'm going to move on. How about some geopolitics to clear our mouth, to cleanse our palate like sorbet in a fancy restaurant, right? A little geopolitics, always do that. Spit out the dirt from domestic politics and go right to foreign affairs. Everybody's watching the Russians all of a sudden, and we told you a bunch of shows ago, why not? I mean, with the elections coming up, if you were going to make a move or do something aggressive or gambling like, you would do it, wouldn't you, right before the presidential election? If some big geopolitical event were to happen and you were going to launch it, why would you launch it today when you could launch it 8 days before the presidential election in the U.S., for example? And so there's been quite a lot of talk about tensions rising, as if they ever went down, between Russia and Ukraine, over all these various places where there are disputes and fighting and terrorism, according to Vladimir Putin. More on that in a minute. And, you know, my problem with all this is I look at the kind of, and we've talked about this before, and I have a very unpopular viewpoint about some of this, because I do think, you know, listen, Putin's a bad guy, and Russia needs some reforms terribly, and I actually feel for the Russian people. I still think there's a chance someday that those people can get rid of this system and have a democracy that is oligarchic, only as bad as ours, as opposed to what they had. I don't think you can hope for much better. But I sort of think what most people think, that Putin is kind of a throwback character in a lot of respects. And so you have to be aware of that. And part of what I think the United States learned when it had to take into account what another power thought, and I think we've forgotten about this since the Soviet Union fell, you know, that there was a time we couldn't just do anything we wanted to as a country. We had another superpower that had the potential to kill every man, woman, and child in our country within a half hour about. And we could do the same to them, which is where the stability supposedly came from. But it meant you couldn't just decide to do something, because you always had to ask the question, well, if we do, what will they do? And there were places where this tit-for-tat thing played out violently. I mean, Korea, 1950, boom, there's an example. Putin is playing a realpolitik game here. And if you're doing that, think, I mean, and look, this is where I get into trouble. I've pointed out over and over again that you need to listen to what your adversaries or your competitors say. Now, when I say this about terrorists, people go ballistic. But what I always point out is if you don't listen to what they say, It's not like you're rewarding them because they blew up a bunch of innocent people and all of a sudden you said, well, what's bothering these people? Let's address their concerns. I mean, we treat that like rewarding terrorism instead of saying, listen, you know, people on the fringe on these issues are starting to blow themselves up and take innocent people with them. Maybe if we dealt with those issues, we'd have less of those people doing that. Seems like it rewards terrorists, doesn't it? Well, I listen to what the Russians continually say, and they continually say that they don't like NATO moving toward their borders. And I continually understand that because who would? Remember, the best way to kind of negotiate with anyone or arbitrate for anyone is to try to put yourself in their shoes, right? You try. If the United States had powerful military alliances moving right up to its borders, it would not like that, and the Russians don't like it either. That's just human. I don't know why we act like, oh my God, they have nothing to fear. I don't know. They're just paranoid. Okay, well, look at the millions and millions and millions and millions of people that they have lost to foreign invasion. Within living memory, you'd be paranoid and xenophobic too. But we should be taking that into account. You can't just say, oh, they're just emotional. I mean, it impacts the way they act. And look at the carrots and sticks you've kind of set up here for a guy like Putin, who is an aggressive gambler, I think. And let's look at his domestic situation, and with the fall in oil prices, his economy, which is never great anyway and is shaky at best, is shakier than normal. You have to watch that. When these rulers, who are essentially unelected people, have their economies go sour on them, they get unpredictable because everyone would like to take everyone's mind off of economic hardships. And at the same time, if you could turn things on in a war economy sense, sometimes you can mask some of those problems for a while. Well, if you're Vladimir Putin and you consider it, as we would, a national security priority to have buffer states around you that are not occupied by what you see as adversarial alliance groups, what does it say to you when NATO, for example, goes to a few more places on Russia's borders and starts the process of NATO expansion? It takes time. You don't get to just become NATO overnight. They usually have, you know, milestones, I guess you could call it. First thing is, okay, you get approved for NATO consideration, and then, you know, you meet this milestone, that milestone, and in 10, 12 years, you're in NATO. Once you're in NATO, of course, you acquire the mythical protection, Article 5 protection, which means NATO will treat an attack on your country as an attack on every country in NATO, right? It's perceived to be an absolutely ironclad shield. We've talked about whether that's true or not, but nonetheless, if you are Vladimir Putin, you must look at this, as any realpolitik person would, as a countdown. A countdown, or maybe a window of opportunity, a window of action, right? How long do you have before a place like the rest of Ukraine is untouchable? Better question, how long do you have before it's a part of NATO? If you consider that occurrence to be a dire one for your national security, I think what we've done is tell this guy, you have until NATO membership kicks in, until Article 5 kicks in, to act. Otherwise, you're going to have NATO there. So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I don't think I'd push people like this. And I think we do. And I think if you read, you know, the things that we do all in these areas, we push, we prod. They do too. It's this great game we play. We play like they're the Soviets. We play the great game like we always have, but we don't give these people the deference we used to, right? We used to pretend that, hey, they could kill every man, woman, and child in the United States in half hour. And because of that, we were careful. I have this feeling that we're just reckless now. And I've talked many times about kind of how we've lost the institutional memory from people who remembered how to play this game, this knife edge game, folks. We came close to nuclear war more than once. Those people are gone. The people that fill the decision-making areas now are people, for the most part, who came to prominence, to the parts of their careers where they were calling the shots and making decisions at a time when there was one superpower. And you didn't have to worry that if you made some dumb decision on Iraq, a local problem involving a country we could easily take out, that you might spark World War III if it went the wrong way. I think we've forgotten that we could spark World War III a whole lot easier than we think, and the people that used to remember how to play games to avoid that are gone now. And so I would just advocate, as I always do, that we be careful. And we be careful what we encourage others to do inadvertently. What we provide excuses for others to do, too. I mean, there would be nothing right about Vladimir Putin launching an attack to take more areas of Ukraine. Nothing right about that. But you're giving him excuses. Right? Things he can say to his own population. NATO was going to move right next to our border. Blah, 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 blah. You got to see that that's what you're setting up, right? And be careful. Because like it or not, they are so much more dangerous than these terrorists we freak out about. I can't even begin to talk about it. I don't even have to tell you, do I? What's our biggest fear that terrorists will do? Maybe get their hands on a nuclear bomb and blow it up in some harbor somewhere? Folks, you know what the Russians are armed with, right? And you say to yourself, well, they would never use those weapons. Of course they wouldn't. But they do have them, right? Why do they have them? Anyway, I'll let you think about that. I know you know the answer. We are reckless. That's a good way to put it. Reckless. Now, coup in Turkey. Maybe we could talk about reckless again. I'm not going to talk about the specific coup in Turkey. I'm going to talk about something that the leader of Turkey insinuated, which was interesting, because we've suggested for a long time that we're going to have problems in this country when other people start looking at how we act and determining that those are the rules then by which every country can act. We did a show, was it way back in 2008, Ben, talking about drones and how the United States was using them at a time when we were the only people who had them. And we pointed out the obvious point, I think, that the United States has a little bit of a problem with this dynamic over time, where we get a hold of some new technology, and instead of understanding that that is a monopoly that's temporary, and that whatever way we use this new technology is going to set the rules for everybody else down the road, we sort of pretend that this monopoly is permanent. Look at nuclear weapons and atomic weapons and the history of that. I mean, when we had a monopoly on nuclear weapons, you know, we would talk about nuking people like, hey, better, Russians better not do it. We'll nuke. And then when they got the bomb, it was everybody's mouth was agape, and it was like, okay, let's, these are very dangerous weapons. Let's talk. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where anybody with half a brain and the people that came up with the atomic bomb had like three brains per person knew that this was going to be a problem. So why did we treat it in that sense, right? Well, okay, so you forgive people when it happens once. But I mean, with drones, it happened again where we were using drones in a way that if other countries did what we were doing, we would cite violations of international law. And now the leader of Turkey, who accuses a Turkish exile who is in Pennsylvania here in the United States of essentially being a terrorist who leads a movement in Turkey that the president of Turkey, this autocratic, I mean, he's a tough guy to get your mind around. Turkey's a weird country in terms of, I mean, they walk so many different fault lines. It's a tough country to run. And this guy is not doing well. I mean, I feel the same way about the Turks that I feel about the Russians. You just would love to see them able to live in a modern democratic society where life was better overall. But I mean, they have such fault lines right now and front line in the war on terror and all those other kind of things. But they were and will be, again, one of the showcase Islamic countries to show how, you know, you can have Islam and modernity at the same time. This guy may be a step backwards in that sense, obviously. And Turkey's had its problems with autocratic rulers and problems with the military. And, I mean, this all plays into Turkish history since the Second World War. But what the Turkish leader said was essentially chiding the United States for harboring a terrorist. You know, Turkey can't get him because he's on our soil. Now, let's understand, we have had cases in this country's history, I remember some in the 1970s, where foreign countries assassinated their people in our country. Their people were here, you know, maybe criticizing their regime, but they were safe on American soil, and they'd send some of their secret agents to our country, and boom, somebody gets shot or something like that. It happened. But Glenn Greenwald's online news outlet, The Intercept, brought up the point which is essentially similar to what we said in that show in 2008, which is, what would we think if some country like Turkey were harboring somebody we said was like Osama bin Laden? So once again, this way we've been treating terrorism, especially since 9/11, which is there's nowhere you can hide, you're either with us or against us. Other countries can do that too, the same way other countries can use drones, the same way other countries can develop atomic and nuclear weapons. I mean, once again, we sort of, when we thought terrorism was our, we set these rules. So now the word terrorist is magic. It's magic. Putin uses it now in this flare-up over Ukraine and Crimea and all this. He's saying Ukrainian terrorists are involved. Well, again, what can you do? The Chinese use this with their problem on their western frontiers with the Uyghur people. It's terrorism. It's the magic word. Legitimizes everything, puts people in a special category, and basically says to a country like ours, you know, you can't cite human rights, you can't cite any of these other things, because we're fighting terrorism just like you do. Now, none of that is what I wanted to talk about today, but I felt like we had to catch up, right? This may be a long show, just like that history show was long. I didn't want to do two more episodes, and so I put it all in one, like the way we ended the long Rome series too. And if you liked it, you're welcome. If you didn't like it, I'm sorry. I never go out there and intend to drop five-hour shows on you, just like I never intend to give you hour-and-a-half common sense shows, but from time to time it does happen. No, I thought I wanted to talk about something that, given what I mentioned in the last program, may make me look like some bleeding heart liberal from the old-fashioned days that I grew up in. Because in the last show, we talked, I believe we called it Revenge of the Gangrenous Finger or something, and we talked about, you know, the people who felt powerless or poor people or marginalized, you know, and the fact that they could make society feel their pain at a certain point. Well, after I did that show, I heard from some folks in the UK, because one of the things we talked about was the British vote to leave the EU. Now, you will recall, folks, that I said that I always hesitate to talk about legislation in foreign countries because, you know, I think the word I used was Byzantine. These systems, just like ours, are all Byzantine. Takes years sometimes of looking at a system to be able to draw some conclusions or make some predictions. And folks in the UK, a couple especially, came and said, listen, you really missed the boat on this. Well, I did say I might, didn't I? But they said, you missed the racial angle. Just like some of the Trump campaign in this country, the racial angle. And I started thinking about this a little bit, because absolutely right. I mean, I think that's a perfect thing to call me on. And I think it's worth talking about because, I mean, obviously we had this Dallas case of domestic terrorism where that African-American, perhaps mentally ill person, opened fire on police officers and killed several. I mean, there's an example where maybe we could talk about racism playing some role in a larger sense. If I could broaden the issue out a little bit. And let me start by saying that, you know, sometimes I'll have conversations with my mom and I'll talk about these conversations on the program. And they're always interesting to me because we view the world very differently from each other. I tend to see big, large, complex things with lots of nuance and gray areas and many things pinging off each other. Whereas her worldview focuses more on things that maybe you could call at the base emotional human level. And she sees things through a different lens, a black and white lens, right? And a lot of it revolves around, you know, things like hate and greed. You know, she sounds like John Lennon or Martin Luther King or Gandhi or Jesus. And you'll sit there and go, you know, we'll talk about this problem here. And she goes, well, it's all hate. There's just too much hate. And a lot of times I'll accuse her of rainbows and unicorns while smiling, you know, in a friendly, nice, cute way. But sometimes I wonder about her point, and if she doesn't have a better point than I usually give her credit for sometimes. And sometimes, you know, I always tell you, I'm 50 now, right? I have a lot of life experience and observational experience under my belt, just like all you other 50-year-olds and older. But there are things I haven't seen in 50 years that I'm seeing now. There are completely new things, And I'm not quite sure what to make of them. You know, I don't, you know, if you're 18 years old and you're listening to this program, there's a lot of stuff you're dealing with in terms of politics and voting and all that stuff for the first time, maybe. So it's all new to you. You get jaded and cynical, and I've seen it all, you know, when you get to my age. But then you see things that you haven't seen. Now, they're not unusual. They happen all the time. We just maybe have been in a period where they haven't been as prominent or as openly displayed in a long time. And it's kind of the way my mother would look at this thing. You know, what if you had a global hate index? You know, I'll drive by these signs in the forest sometimes, and it'll say the fire index, current fire conditions, and they'll have an arrow, and there'll be a green area and a yellow area and then a red area signifying, you know, the growing fire danger. And wherever that arrow points to will show you how bad it is. And if it's in the red area, obviously, you have a problem. Well, I mean, I always think of hate as an individual emotion. But then I started thinking about what my mom said and looking around, and I'm going to broaden this out, and I'm going to explain where it kind of all comes from in my mind. But I feel like, and it's anecdotal, obviously, and it's a feeling, but I wonder if you don't feel the same way, that the amount of sheer hatred in our society right now is at a level that I don't ever remember. And I would like to suggest that it's not just our society, that something is going on globally. And maybe you could suggest that it is different conditions in different places. And I don't want to suggest, by the way, that hate is ever non-existent. I mean, I always think of hate as part of the toxic stew that is reality. And there's always a pinch of hate in there. You know, maybe your pinch of hate in the early 1990s is in the former Yugoslavia, that as it's breaking up, ancient ethnic hatreds arise, and you see these people that just hate each other. But it's isolated, or it's localized. You always have hate, right? But what happens if it appears to be growing and relatively international? I mean, if you say that you always have hate, but sometimes the fire danger on the hate index sign, you know, is pointing to green, and sometimes it's pointing to red. And I thought to myself, okay, even with all of my ideas about complex systems and chaos and pinging off each other and, you know, leadership positions and all this stuff, if you had twice as much hate than you had 10 years ago on individual levels, does that impact everything else? I mean, you can't say it doesn't, because take racists, for example, which I'm appalled by the amount of open racism I see all around me right now. I can't process it. It doesn't make sense to me. But the racists vote. In a democratic society, could you argue that this makes a big difference? I mean, everybody can hate each other all they want in a dictatorship, but they can't do much about it. In this society, you can vote for people based on how you hate them. And now I know it seems like I'm just ranting here, so let me back up and put this into some context. We have a weird dichotomy going on in this country right now. And the dichotomy is, on one hand, we have a level of political correctness that threatens to stifle free speech. And I hear about this all the time, and people are very hard on me because I don't talk more about it. And what I always say is, for me, the line is when the government gets involved. Culture changes. Values change. If it's not okay to use the N-word openly in society, not because you'll get arrested, but because, you know, five people will punch you in the mouth, I'm not sure that I'm going to get up here and argue that, listen, everybody has a right to free speech. You should not be punched in the mouth for yelling the N-word. I'm not sure. I know the government shouldn't arrest you for it. So, I mean, that's why I always get into trouble for not talking about this stuff. But it's a huge issue right now in the United States among some people. College campuses, for example, you know, words that hurt people, trigger words, I mean, all these kinds of things. So on one hand, you have what appears to be almost an over-concern for these kind of things. On the other hand, if you're 50 like I am, have you ever seen so much openly displayed racism in America? And I mean ugly, hideous tweets, and I can't get my mind around whether we are seeing a rise, you know, on the global hate index, and we're seeing hate go up for various reasons. Maybe if I think about it, all of my wonderfully complex geopolitical interactions and blah, 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 and because of that, people are more hateful. I remember a person from Bosnia telling me that everyone was getting along just fine until economic conditions tanked and then all those old antagonisms arose. So maybe you could make some sort of complex sociological case why the global hate index, the Dan Carlin, let's put a trademark on this, Ben, the Dan Carlin global hate index might be rising. But if it does, what does that mean? And look at Europe. I mean, in my lifetime, and Europeans can contradict me on this, as they did on some of the Brexit stuff, so please feel free, Europeans. But I mean, I don't remember in Western Europe in my lifetime this kind of hate. And I understand why it is, by the way. I mean, you know, there's another fine line here when you talk about, for example, the immigrant situation in Europe right now. And the fine line, and Peggy Noonan, the former Reagan speechwriter, just had a column about this today, where she talked about how the global elites can sit there and say, yes, take everybody. You know, all these people can come in and you're a racist and a hater if you won't let them. But they're not moving the people and the newcomers and all this into the elite neighborhoods. They're moving them in with some of the regular people who are just striving to get by in life and doesn't always work out so well. And there's one person who called me, a guy from London, about the whole Brexit thing. He said, listen, in my community, it's Polish people. He goes, I like Polish people. But it's unusual all of a sudden to have a bunch of people move in and your community around you changed. You liked it the way it was. You don't mind having Polish people there, but you don't want it to turn Polish on you. That's a human thing, isn't it? Wanting things to stay the way they are and for newcomers to come in and blend rather than take over and change what you liked, right? You had it the way you wanted it. Why did somebody come in and change it? But when does that cross the line to hate brown people or all Muslims are evil? Or using the N-word for black folks. I mean, Twitter and Facebook and the things people say when they comment after news stories, I haven't seen that in my adult lifetime in this country. And one could argue it's because people didn't have the ability to express themselves like they do now. You might have had to go to the trouble to go Xerox a bunch of racist leaflets and leave them on people's windshields at the local supermarket to get the point across. In the old days, you really have to care to go that far, but maybe you're reading a news story that you link to, and you just go, you know, stupid brown people, blah, 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 blah. A lot easier to express yourself in that sense, and a lot of times it's anonymous, so we're all wearing KKK hoods, I guess, when we're racist online. I'm sure there are folks out there listening, people of color, who are saying, nice of you to wake up to what we've always known, Dan, and no, the racism's no worse than it ever was. It's just as bad as it always was. I can hear you. But from my standpoint, perception can be reality in a little bit of a sense. And when you see the amount of hate going on right now, and as I said, there's a wonderful dichotomy where on one level, it's people saying, you know, the PC police are out and they're freaking out over every little word. And then you go online and innate every little word. It's the most horrible, wretched, racist stuff you've ever seen. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's like we have both ends of the extreme and nothing settling things down in a way that might lower the global hate index. Again, I tend to see problems at a giant geopolitical, you know, level, but what if my mom's lower level lens is pointing out a problem that needs to be addressed? I mean, if you decided you had a problem in your country with hate, and we talked about this, didn't we, in a show, was it two shows ago, Ben, when we said Americans hate each other? Some of these groups just hate each other. If you decided that was a problem, what could you do at the legislative level about that? I mean, I did grow up. I didn't grow up in the era where you had this just blatant hate like this. I didn't grow up in very hateful places, though, either. I should emphasize that. Los Angeles was pretty integrated and pretty multiracial. But nonetheless, I remember in the entire 1970s, the mass media in this country was part of trying to expose these ideas and address them. I mean, if you go watch something like All in the Family now, first of all, they don't put it on very much anymore because even though it's a very liberal show that took a very liberal stance back in the very early 1970s, mostly was when it was very controversial, because of the way things have changed, even trying to make that stance today offends a lot of people. But the point was is that that was just one of many mass media productions that dealt with these kinds of issues of race and bigotry and prejudice and helped sort of, maybe you could say, nursemaid us, airlock us, transition us from, you know, a different era. And really the 50s and 40s in this country and with Jim Crow, and I mean, all that, we're in a very different era now. And I think part of the reason why is that there was a conscious effort to kind of civilize the culture, maybe you could say. What's doing that now? What takes that place? I mean, again, let's imagine that either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton gets to be president and that some of us stay in this country and don't emigrate. I mean, if we're still here and either one of those people decided that this was a problem, what would you do to address it? And whether we're talking about legislative solutions, thou shalt not have PC codes on college campuses, or maybe just using the bully pulpit to try to lead in a sense that you, you know, what would one president say, call Americans to a higher value or a higher calling, and you've got to sort of reestablish some tolerance and love for your countrymen, right? And this idea that we could talk to each other the way racists would talk to each other on some deep South. I mean, you just, it's as I said earlier, I don't have a frame of reference for this. The level of hate that I see all around me now is new in my life. And as I said, I'm 50. I probably don't remember anything before about 1972. So there may have been quite a bit of this right before my memory kicked in. But I don't remember, I just don't remember this level of hatred. And the racial stuff online, folks, it is, you know, here's what I worry about. I worry about that there's a lot of people being completely desensitized to it. I did not grow up with people yelling racial epithets at people all the time. But online today, you see it constantly. Constantly. Social media, news, constantly. So what does some kid growing up today, and I wouldn't be surprised if 40% of the people online who are the worst offenders are like 13-year-old boys, but nonetheless, what are the 13-year-old boys reading that and growing up with that as part of their norm going to grow up to be? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I feel like we are somehow allowing a fire that was quelled decades ago to gain steam again, and I don't know how we would put it out again if we tried, if we wanted to, if we could, if we even made it a priority. I mean, I think if one of the candidates from the big two parties won the presidency and got up in their first address and said, we have to stop the hate, it's poisoning our society, it's toxic, blah, 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 half the country's going to look at them and say, F you! It's going to work out really well, isn't it? And again, if it's localized, maybe you could say the United States just has a problem, right? It's the Yugoslavia of the 21st century in terms of growing hatred, but you see this all over the place, right? When was the last time you saw Europe where you could just see racism like this? And as I'm sure Europeans would say, listen, Dan, the racism was always here. We didn't have so many people to get us angry, though, right? You know, or it's easy to be tolerant when they're not here. When they're here, you know, the rubber meets the road in terms of that, and a lot of people don't like it. And then you get problems where cultures clash and people get raped in some of these countries and people get killed and terrorists seep in amongst the, you know, refugees. And again, I don't think this is all racism, folks. I think sometimes people have a point. But at the same time, go on Twitter, go on Facebook and read these news stories and read the comments afterwards. That's straight up horrible, ugly, gross racism. I think where I was caught off guard, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, is I thought that this was a permanent trend. I thought when, for example, in the 1970s, we were involved in maybe what you could call a soft landing from the earlier era. I mean, people forget in this country, because most people weren't alive and can't remember it, and that includes me, that there were separate, I mean, you couldn't stay in a hotel in this country, in a ton of states, if you were a black person, unless it was a black person's hotel. One of the hard problems that people had in this country when we first started integrating sports teams is a team would go to some city, and the white players could all stay in the nice hotel, and the black players all had, I mean, we think about that as crazy today, don't we? Of course we do. And that was a really hard thing to bring you down, a soft landing from that. And there was a lot of effort put into it. But there was a misconception, because I remember the arguments. The arguments over what do you do about the hardcores, right? Because the younger people coming up were all much more tolerant and much less racist. And so the attitude everybody had was that the problem here are the old folks who are too set in their ways to change. And the solution that was often thrown out was that they're going to die. We're going to age our way out of the last bits of this problem, and then we're done, right? It's a phase. It's a transition phase. And once all the Archie Bunker types are gone, that's the end of that. We never envisioned it going the other way, that progress might be temporary. And so it's not, I haven't incorporated that into my thinking. I haven't accounted for that. And I did start to kind of reevaluate my mom's approach, though, a little bit. So when she talks about things like hate, I went back and I thought, all right, she's talking about something that's an individual emotion, but what if we increase the number of individuals who have it? If you doubled the amount of racism in any given country, what are the real-world effects of that? Now, on an individual level, it's obvious, right? More discrimination, maybe more racial attacks and this and that and the other thing. And by the way, let's point out, everybody can be racist. This isn't a problem of white people on people of color. It's a problem of people of all colors, sometimes hating people of other colors. I mean, it's everywhere, folks, right? And it's all over the world. As the friend from London told me, the problem in his neighborhood were white people, a ton of them blonde-haired people. They were Polish people. They were just changing things too much for the locals. And you know, we all have that problem. I go back to my old neighborhood and say all these rich people came in here and changed it. If we just had more immigration controls on those people, might be able to maintain a certain standard of living and not have to move. See, I could play that game too. A lot of this is very human, and there must have been some evolutionary advantage to this once upon a time. It's such a huge part of our makeup, though, and not so much racism as our tribe here and then all the outsiders. So I don't know where that came from or what the point is. I just know I had no inkling that you could move backwards on this, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. And what if you decided that you needed to address this, that this became a problem? We talk about national security, and we always think about guns and tanks and bombs, but if you think about what the term means, it means anything that might threaten the nation. If you doubled the amount of hate we have now or tripled it, does that threaten the nation? Remember, we threw out a line earlier. I mean, the racists vote. You can see the rise in the right-wing parties in Europe. I will say, and it's something that gets me into trouble sometimes because I think people take offense at this, but when you try, and I always do this, I think I've told you before, I'm one of those people that likes to look at big problems and then as sort of a mental exercise say, well, you know, if I could do anything, how would I solve this problem? If I look at this question of rising hate and racism and all this kind of stuff, and there are two problems that have a lot of crossover, how would you address it today? If you got into office and rolled your sleeves up and said, the number one problem in this country is Americans hate each other too much and there's a rise in racism, so I'm going to fix it. What do you do? And I thought to myself, you know, what's sad is that one of the things that would really help is to have terms that had the kind of power they used to have. To, you know, if you think about this as an analogy maybe with antibiotics and how once upon a time, some of these things that don't work on much of anything today used to be wonder drugs, silver bullets, right? You called somebody a racist in the 1970s and some of the 1980s, and it was a very powerful term. It was like invoking the Holocaust. Invoking the Holocaust, once upon a time, I mean, there was just, I can't describe to people who weren't there how important something like the Holocaust was in terms of really making us understand anti-Semitism and the real-world dangers and how powerful these terms were. But the problem is that they're so powerful, it's just so tempting to use them on all kinds of things. This is a human thing we talk about with the U.S. government all the time, right? These special laws that the U.S. government passes to go after something like the mafia. And then they find out, well, God, it's such a useful tool. We could get all kinds of progress done. Well, if racism, to just pick one example, is this wonderful silver bullet in the 1970s, use it everywhere, right? Stamp out racism by citing it and calling it what it is and using that powerful term. But if you use it on less and less large things, it doesn't mean they're not important. But it means you make something that was this wonderful wonder drug, penicillin, and you make it much more pedestrian. And others become resistant to it. They're no longer shocked by it. And they start to think maybe even that it's overused and brought out for all sorts of purposes that are nowhere near as big as the major things that you realized you were talking about when you brought up terms like racism in the 1970s. In the 1970s, it had been just a few years before that that people had to go to separate hotels in a lot of U.S. states. So the term was powerful. There's a lot of terms like that, by the way, that we have overused, and you've cut the guts out of them. And the problem is, just like with the antibiotics, is that we don't have anything to take their place. And it's an unusual problem because if you get too legislative about it, which is the way the government is accustomed to fighting problems and acting, you run into huge constitutional questions. I mean, it doesn't seem controversial today, but even saying something like if you're going to run a place of business, you cannot discriminate against customers based on, well, almost anything. Once upon a time, people used to say, it's my business. I should be able to do business with anyone I want to. And you'll still hear a lot of people say that. It's a smaller number because people understand if you don't do that, what'll happen, right? But the point is that every time you want to solve these things by passing a new law, you run into all kinds of problems. I mean, for example, what if you decided that the hate speech is creating whole new generations of young Archie Bunkers that people like yours truly couldn't have even imagined was a possibility? How do you fight that? Well, if you get too legislative with people's rights to say things or express themselves, that's the First Amendment. That's what so many people are upset about the PC thing on college campuses. This is why you run into problems. The amount of tools you have to fight something like this are frighteningly small. What's more, and I know I've bored you with these stories before, but we have, and it's always been around since colonial America, but nothing like in the past 30 years, we have an industry that has cropped up, and its goals are, unsurprising, money. But corporations and individuals are making untold amounts of money dividing people from one another and stoking anger at your countrymen. And the funny thing is, a lot of these shows will do it in ways that couch it in patriotism, and there'll be flags everywhere, and you think to yourself, really? Can you really call it patriotic when you're taking a big segment of the population and making them angry at another big section of the population for money? When I was in radio, the big arguments I had, and they were endless. I've never had arguments with adults since then like this. I mean, almost physical. The last physical fight I almost got into with a grown human being was over these kind of questions. But they were talking about the need to create heat. And heat meant controversy and stoke anger and pit something against something else. You needed to have an antagonist that you could focus the. And the reason that the corporation that ran the station I was at wanted to do this wasn't because they were racist. It's because the consultants in the radio business were absolutely convinced that this is how you made a great show. This is how you raised the numbers of people listening. This is how you more engage those who already did listen. This is how you created buzz about your program. In other words, all of the carrots and sticks argued for more anger, more division, and all these kinds of things for very, solid business reasons. But that's a negative dynamic when you think about it, isn't it? Because if you decided tomorrow, we need to go back to something like in the 70s where we tried to get a handle on this growing problem that will destroy this country in 40 years if we don't do something about the current trends, you are talking about damaging the profits of a ton of very profitable entities right now. And as we said in the last show about poverty, none of this stuff is the kumbaya, bleeding heart, hippy-dippy stuff maybe it sounds like on the surface. This is about maintaining the integrity of your system. And I don't mean like the moralistic integrity. I mean the structural integrity. To me, when you look at something like that terrible Dallas police shooting where that veteran, maybe mentally ill veteran, opens fire and kills those Dallas police officers, to me, he's doing what a lot of other terrorists do. Because, folks, terrorism is usually a case of the fringe elements acting out violently over causes, though, that many other people sympathize with. They just wouldn't act violently about it. In other words, you begin to see the most vulnerable people amongst us, whether they are the least sane or the most radical or what have you, those people are always the ones that are the first to go to the next level, right? The ones most normal people won't do. For example, you could have an entire black community angry about the way police treat racial minorities, but you don't often have people open fire on police officers about it, right? That's the fringe. But the more angry people get, the larger the fringe gets. Now, I'm using that as an example to talk about systemic integrity, but it doesn't have to be a black person. I mean, we had a white kid shoot up a church and kill a bunch of black folks not that long ago either. All of these things are like little tiny termite bites that weaken the structure of state little by little. And when you think about what to do about this, you know, it's interesting. I said earlier that the best way in my mind to try to at least have a starting point, to know what you're dealing with, find out what the parameters are, is to actually listen to what your opponent, adversary, enemy, depends on the situation, is saying. So on one of these websites where I was just sitting there, I mean, mouth agape, and I'm a grown man. I should be used to this by now. I've seen everything, right? I mean, come on. Mouth agape at the racial conversations on a main. I'm not on Stormfront here, right? I think it was Time Magazine or something. One guy who had been spouting all this racist stuff said, you know, that they want separation. In other words, he wants to live in a world where there are only people of his color. Now, I thought about that for a minute. And, you know, your first thought is that the whole thing is appalling. But after a while, you start to think to yourself, well, wait a minute. It's one thing if you're waiting for all the old people who still keep the old flame and the old ideas alive to die away so you can have a better society. What do you do if instead of it being the old people, the Archie Bunkers we're creating in this new world are 13 years old today? They're not going away anytime soon. So unless they all have personal transformations over the course of their lifetime, we are potentially seeing at least the most comfortable with being open about it racist generation that we've seen in decades in this country and maybe across the world. Is that a problem? Well, the guy who talked about separation, I sat down for a second and I thought afterwards, well, if this is how it's going to be, and if we're creating more of these people every day, and my choice is to live with them continually or have them go off and live by themselves together with their own kind, I'm not so sure. I think I'd try first. I'd try to fix it. I would give it the old college try. But I mean, if all else fails, and that's what that guy really wanted, you start to think after a while, hey, pal, you want to leave and you want to take people who think like you with you, please go. We'll be a better country without you. But then I realize, well, that's the country kind of breaking up, isn't it? So how does that impact national security? We spend unbelievable amounts of money on national security, folks. Could money help this problem? Could you spend $100 billion on, you know, helping Americans to once again live together as countrymen and promote that kind of patriotism? Or would that be money down a rat hole because it's not the kind of problem you can fix with cash? You kind of need an antibiotic, don't you? And you kind of don't have one. Wouldn't it be crazy if what ended up killing our country wasn't those giant, complicated things yours truly thinks about, but was instead, maybe you could call it the historical equivalent of a common cold? Instead of it being some complex element and dynamic created by the modern world and globalization and 21st century realities and all this kind of stuff, it's something as pedestrian as that age-old, maybe evolutionary development that allowed us to make a distinction between us and them. I, for one, for my own selfish purposes, certainly hope not. I don't want to eat all that crow my mom will serve to me after I have to admit I've been wrong this entire time. We've been telling you about Audible on this program for years. They are the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, and I've watched them and talked about them as they grew and grew and grew and played a key role in this revolution. And I'm not sure enough people are aware of what a revolution it is, but as a guy whose podcasts sometimes stretch into audiobook territory, I think I have a pretty good read on how people devour content. To take something that is a text-based thing, and I'm a huge fan of text-based things, but sometimes you need your hands and your eyes to do other things. But that doesn't mean you can't enjoy a good book or magazine or something along those lines that would have previously required you to sit down in a nice quiet corner, open up the book, and give it your full attention. Now you can mow the lawn and read a book. I had a long-haul trucker after I started doing these ads once saying, you might be surprised how literate some long-haul truckers are. They've got a lot of time to read. But of course you can't look down and, well, not many people can anyway, look down and read a book while driving, but you sure can listen to an audiobook. And, you know, it's funny because I approach the different times I talk about Audible with you in different ways. In this case, I couldn't help but go on Audible and try to find a nice book to recommend you, usually one I've read before. But I got stuck on one that I think I've already probably told you about. I don't know. I can't remember all the things I said to you folks. But it was The Lord of the Rings, which is a favorite of mine. I've read it many times since I was a kid. And there's a funny, interesting thing about audiobooks that's different than text, and that's that when you do text, and I love this about it, your brain creates the voice of the narration. I have no other way to describe it other than that, but when I read The Lord of the Rings and I read it again and again and again, it's the same sort of thing, and I love it every time. But when you go on to Audible, you have not one but multiple versions of The Lord of the Rings as told by different people, and each one puts a whole different spin on it for me because it's not the normal voice that I've had in my head for all the times I've re-listened. In a weird sort of way, it's taken one of my favorite, you know, book series and added something that makes it new enough to make it worth listening to again. Does that make sense? In other words, taking some of your favorite books and giving you a reason to go check them out again. For example, one of the narrators is a guy, and I don't know any of these people, so I hope I pronounce his name correctly, Rob Inglis. And when I listened to him, I thought he sounds like a storyteller like Tolkien himself might have been, where you sit down and they've got the English accent and he sounds like you're telling a story. And it was wonderful. Very different than the voice in my head. But then I listened to a different version, which has three different narrators, Ian Holm, Michael Hordern, and Robert Steffens. And when I heard that one, and you can listen to audio samples, by the way, on Audible. It's worth going on there and just checking out how the different voices totally sort of change the lens or the color on the story and kind of make it new again. And I loved the narration by Ian Holm and company. It sounded more like the way I thought I would have done it, right? In any case, I thought, why recommend a book that I liked and I think you may like when I can recommend one of your favorites? If you haven't gone and read one of your favorite books by letting somebody else read it to you, maybe a very, very talented person who adds a new element to the book that makes it all new and wonderful for you again, or maybe somebody whose interpretation conflicts so much with yours it grates on you, might want to check that out. And you can go do that without any obligation at all. Go to their website, click on the sample, and you can listen to a little of all the narration. But if you like it and you'd rather get it for free, well, listen, they have an offer going on right now where if you sign up for their service, you get your first book free. So a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin if you want to do that. And just for the fun of it, go on there and hear the free sample of how your favorite book sounds. And if you like the way it sounds, well, you might want to pick that up because your favorite book might be new enough to make it fun to read all over again by having some talented voice actor read it to you.
If you are not already following us on Twitter, please do so. The address is at DC Common Sense.
You want to help the podcast? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on DanCarlin.com, and Dan and Ben will get a percentage of what you spend. It doesn't cost you a penny more, and it helps these guys out because they are nice young fellas.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to DanCarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.